GWA 517, do you want to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
Number 71, Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody at above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
Number 71, Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Something. It's a UFO.
Yeah. It's Merger 295, yeah, something just passed over us. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy?
Yeah.
Did we just call about the UFOs? They're out there. Same airplanes.
Howdy, dispatch.
Okay.
Bob, I swear to God, four calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty. Four calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com. Today's guest, Gary, doesn't really need an introduction, as he is very well known in the field of ufology. His interest of UFOs, anti-gravity, and the suppression of free energy got him in a little bit of trouble with the US government. And that is a big understatement. Due to conflicting work schedules, Gary was kind enough to give us the audio for today's podcast. Please welcome Gary McKinnon.
In March of 2002, I was arrested for hacking into Army, Navy and Air Force computers, as well as the Pentagon and NASA. The arresting officers from the National High-Tech Crime Unit, which is now part of SOCA, the Serious Organized Crime Agency, told me that I'd probably do 6 months community service. This turned out to be a highly inaccurate prediction. My arresting officers went to Washington and met with some top brass to discuss my case and also to illegally hand over my hard drive to US authorities, which they're still in possession of. The police officers were obviously very impressed by the military officers they'd met because when they returned from Washington and interviewed me for the second time, they had a very serious tone about them. It was a very different ballgame by then. The second interview was in the summer of 2002, in August, I think. And in November of the same year, the US authorities announced that they intended to extradite me to stand trial in America. And that on paper, at least, I was facing 70 years in jail, which was a far cry from 6 months community service. So that was very shocking. At the time they announced their intention to extradite, the extradition treaty between the UK and the US required that evidence be produced that strongly supported the allegations before a UK citizen could be taken to the US. US citizens were protected by the Constitution, and strong evidence was also required to extradite them. Unfortunately for me, my case, amongst others, it was at a time when hacking was a big problem, and my case and others had catalyzed the US and the UK into arranging an entirely new extradition treaty, one where supporting evidence was no longer required to extradite a UK citizen to the US, but you guys were still protected by the Constitution. And this necessary imbalance, as one of the architects of the treaty once called it, still exists to this day. Going from 6 months community service to the thought of the rest of my life in a foreign prison was obviously a major leap and a terrifying one. The US authorities called my actions the biggest military computer hack ever, which is patently untrue since there have been a few viruses that got into many more computers than I did. I got into less than 100, I think it was about 97. But the real bottom line here was the damage accusations. I was accused of damaging every PC that I was on and told that the amount of damage I'd done to each PC was exactly $5,000 worth. And that happened to be the magic figure necessary to support an extradition request. So I realized I was being fitted up for the damage. I knew I hadn't done any damage, but you can't prove a negative. Under the new treaty, there was no burden of proof for the US. They just had to state your crime and your name. So it was looking very bleak, very bad for me. 2 years went by without me hearing much more. This was due to the treaty having to be ratified by the Senate. For some reason, they were dragging their heels, which was odd, since when I'd read the draft of the treaty, it was actually written in US English with American spelling, which was kind of telling. I lost my career in IT due to this, so I went and got my forklift license and got a job in a local luggage warehouse. I then lost this job due to all the publicity. Lost the room I'd rented because the landlord didn't like all the press hanging around. Lost my girlfriend of 12 years, so I was feeling pretty crappy, to understate it hugely. And spent those 2 years very down, unemployed. In 2005, I got another job. Strangely working for EDS, Electronic Data Systems, a large American company. I finished my first day and then made my way home. And as I was walking down the road to my front door, three gigantic men approached me, big burly men, identified themselves as the New Scotland Yard Extradition Squad, and escorted me up to my room that I was renting in a shared house. They insisted on taking my computer, even though they could see I had no internet in the house. They informed me that I was a fugitive from US law, which I thought was kind of strange. How can you be a fugitive when you're not trying to escape, you know? Once again, like the logic of international law enforcement had escaped me, but there was no actual escape for me because the officers drove me to the police station. I submitted to a DNA sample. You're told if you refuse that, they just keep you in a cell until they get permission from the high inspector. I was to appear in court the next day for my bail conditions to be set, and this was to be in court for an extradition hearing, not the actual criminal trial. I wasn't given the opportunity to wash or change my clothes, so I walked into court looking like a complete scruff bag. And I could see the distaste on the face of the judge, or perhaps he always looked like that, I don't know. The US asked for a £10,000 bail, and for me to have to sign on at my local police station every single hour, which was impossible. My local police station was half an hour from where I lived, so I'd either have to get no sleep or sleep at the police station. Luckily, the judge saw that this was a nonsense request, so I was required to sign on at the police station each evening, eventually. We also got the bail dropped to £5,000 since I'd lost my job. My parents foster children for a living, didn't have any savings at the time. Excuse me. My bail was paid by friends and family, all contributing what they could. I'll go over the rest of the events in less depth, since it's just a chronology of court hearings and decisions. It's kind of like the boring bit, the very depressing but boring to retell. In 2006, I had my first extradition hearing. And the judge ruled that my extradition could be allowed, but the final decision was to be made by the Home Secretary, who also decided it was fine to send me over there without any evidence of damage. The US authorities started to play dirty, saying that if I didn't come over of my own free will, then they'd give me the maximum 70-year sentence once I was over there. My solicitor was told by Ed Gibson, who was the attaché at the US Embassy at the time, that they wanted to see me fry, which was, of course, a reference to the electric chair. They also threatened me with imprisonment in America under Military Order Number 1, which means a secret trial with a jury of military personnel, no opportunity to speak to the press. And they also informed me I'd be allowed no visits from anyone. So they're putting the pressure on, which the DOJ, as you may or may not know, it always does. In 2007, we went to the High Court to try and overturn the decision of the Home Secretary to allow the extradition, but the High Court refused to do so. And then in 2008, we went to the House of Lords, but they also refused to overturn the decision. So the next avenue was to go to the European Court of Human Rights. And we lost the appeal to go there, let alone actually be heard there. Later that year, I was doing an interview on ITV. And after the interview, quite a few people contacted ITV to say that they thought I was on the autistic spectrum, that I should get diagnosed by a professional to see if this was the case. I didn't like being told I may be on the spectrum, and I was far too depressed to welcome people analysing me and, you know, poking around in my brain. But I went along with it since everyone was advising me to do so. And ultimately, I was diagnosed by 5 or 6 of the top people in the UK. And they all agreed that I had Asperger's, I was on the spectrum. And as I said, no one likes being diagnosed as having a syndrome of any kind, but it did explain a lot. People had always thought I was a little bit weird and kind of robotic ever since school. So now at least I had some kind of explanation for that, you know, something to blame it on. But it turned out that having Asperger's helped with the case as well, because it's a medical condition. since my actions were due to my hyperinflated sense of truth and justice, which is apparently quite common in people with Asperger's. A normal person would have broken the law in the way that I did to find information on UFOs. It was a very extreme act. I can see that now. In late 2008, we appealed to the new Home Secretary, but she also had no sympathy for my situation and said she would allow the extradition. And then in 2009, we had a judicial review, and we found out Crown Prosecution Service, which is like the English Department of Justice, that the US authorities had no evidence whatsoever that I'd done any damage. It was pure hearsay, yet the CPS still refused to prosecute me in my own country, which is what I was asking. I wasn't asking to be let off and go scot-free. I wanted a UK trial, basically, excuse me. We then asked to appeal to the Supreme Court, something we didn't have when I was first arrested. We were refused leave to appeal to the Supreme Court. And then in late 2009... the Home Office agreed to put the extradition on hold while they looked at our medical evidence. But they said they'd received assurances from the US authorities that all of my medical needs would be met in a US prison. That statement was patently untrue, since US jails have a very bad record when it comes to looking after mentally ill inmates. There's lots of reports that have you. In December of 2009, we submitted a new High Court appeal to challenge the extradition. And in January, we were allowed the new judicial review. In the spring of 2010, the new Home Secretary, Theresa May, she agreed to put the extradition on hold again while the new medical evidence was looked at. And in the summer of the same year, Prime Minister David Cameron and President Obama mentioned my case on television, hoping that they could work together to find a suitable solution. And in September of 2010, we finally managed to get a review of the extradition treaty itself. Baroness Patricia Scotland, one of the people that helped push the treaty through, said herself that the treaty was necessarily imbalanced due to US citizens being protected by the Constitution. And David Blunkett, who had signed the treaty in the UK, admitted that we might have given too much away. In the spring of 2011, on a visit to the UK, President Obama said he'd respect any decision made by the UK judicial system, which was good to hear. That year, we had growing support from the Conservative Party, which is like your Republicans over here. And apart from a few noble individuals, the Labour Party, which is like your Democrats, were absolutely useless and had no qualms in sending me across the pond. By this time, I'd been severely depressed for years. I was on Prozac. I was really barely leaving the house. I'd also bought enough potassium chloride to kill myself with. Rather than facing 70 years in a foreign jail, potassium chloride is the third chemical used in the triple set of chemicals for lethal injection. As far as I was concerned, these people wanted to see me fry or see me rot, so I wasn't going to let them control the terms or the method of my demise. In 2012, I refused to see the government-appointed doctors. I'd already been assessed by the top independent people in the land and saw no reason to submit to further tests. Especially since the pair of doctors the government wanted to use had a track record of getting the results the government wanted, you know what I mean. And finally, on October the 15th in 2012, Theresa May announced her decision to block the extradition. My family, my girlfriend and I, we cried like babies for like hours. Just, you know, pure relief, 10.5 years worth of tears just running down our faces. There was still the possibility of a UK trial, which is what I've been campaigning for all this time. But in December, on my mum's birthday, the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, announced that there would be no UK trial and the ordeal is finally up. So that's the decade-long legal battle, the chronology of events. But I think it's also important to give you a very brief history of me and why I decided to hack into these systems. I was born in Glasgow in 1966. I had no siblings. My parents broke up when I was six. Spent another year living in Glasgow, living with my dad, before going down to London to live permanently with my mum and stepdad. My parents always encouraged the use of imagination and creativity, so I was quite a self-sufficient child in terms of play and recreation. On top, I was always asking questions about the stars, the moon, and the other planets. And this fascination just grew as I got older, always maintaining a sort of layperson's interest in astronomy and physics and all things space related. I did have one UFO sighting myself, just the one. It's the only time I've ever seen something with my own eyes in the sky that I just couldn't explain. I was in my bedroom that was at the top of the house at the time. It was about 11 or 12, I think, just looking up at the sky at dusk. I saw this glowing red light just zooming from my very high extreme left, going at a massive arc right across the sky to the horizon on my right. But it wasn't traveling in a straight line. It was really jiggling. It was like brownie in motion, doing lots of seemingly random wiggles as it followed this course. It was a very strange thing. I mean, yeah, if you had been flying in that thing, I would have felt you'd just be thrown around like a rag doll, but who knows. When I was about 12, I joined BUFORA, the British UFO Research Association, which is still going strong today. The extension of an interest in the stars to an interest in the life that may live in the planets around those stars is a natural. The thought that someone may be visiting us was extremely interesting, extremely interesting. Of course, as a boy turns into a young man, he develops other interests. And my passion for science and strange phenomena was put on the back burner for some time as I started to explore other aspects of life. I left school and spent years doing different jobs, from laboring to hairdressing to office jobs, factory work, warehouse work. I spent about a year in each job looking for something that could hold my interest. As my dad always said, most jobs aren't interesting, son. That's why they pay you to do them. It's obviously. I didn't leave school with many qualifications, but I did have a passion for computers. I was a self-taught programmer, first in BASIC and then in assembly language or machine code. And if you're that sort of person, then you'll know that you end up being the one that all your friends call for help. Their computers go wrong. Still happens to this day. Very annoying. And then one day someone suggested I should try and get a job in computing, which, weird, I'd never thought of myself. Not having any formal qualifications or experience, the only jobs I could get initially were installation and upgrade contracts, where our business was moving from like Windows 3.11 to Windows for work groups. Yes, it was a long time ago. And as time went on, my experience grew. I was eventually contracting, doing network installations, maintenance, troubleshooting, and eventually systems administration. Then one day, at one of my jobs in 93 or 94, I got my first look at the internet. Wow. Using the Mosaic browser. I was amazed that we could view text and images on the computers on the other side of the world. It's fantastic. I knew it'd be a big thing in time to come, and I definitely wanted it in my house too, not just at work. Even though Microsoft famously said it didn't think there was anything to it, but I don't know if that's a rumor that's true, but apparently it is. I got my first dial-up connection in 95. By then we had a variety of search engines, no Google yet. And millions of websites, so it had already become a useful resource. And the number of UFO enthusiast sites was astounding, so many of them, I could hardly believe it. I had a lot of catching up to do, so whatever I could, I'd browse the net, reading up on UFO history and how the phenomena had grown over the years. Around this time, fuel prices were very high in my country. We had cases of elderly people in the UK having to choose between warmth and food. We called it heat or eat, heating or eating. And many of them died due to hypothermia because they couldn't afford to pay their fuel bills. And it's a growing problem to this day. In 2015, 15,000 people in Britain died due to so-called fuel poverty. 15,000 people. And one subject I've read a lot about in connection with UFOs was the free energy. You know, a power source that was virtually unlimited, output more energy than was required to operate it. They call them over-unity devices. And it's not a mystery, by the way. Everyone has an over-unity device in their home. It's your fridge. The average refrigerator is about three times over-unity. Because the heat it puts out, you can't make the heat it puts out with the electricity that goes in. A very well-made fridge, like a science laboratory fridge, can be up to five or six times over-unity. Interesting fact. So although you can't create or destroy energy, you can transform it and kind of amplify it somehow. I don't know. I'm not a physicist. So in my mind, these lines of thoughts converge. Old people dying, no energy, then possibly free energy that's been hidden from us. Hugely unfair. So many of today's problems could be solved if we had free energy. And the UFOs that I've read so much about and watched so many videos of, they seem to operate on a propulsive principle that was extremely advanced and probably tapping the zero-point energy that I'd read about. Literally pumping electrons, you know, from the fluctuations of the fabric of the universe. This crazy stuff. So why didn't we have this technology? You know, many countries around the world had a serious interest in UFOs, even detailing in their Air Force's instruction manuals how to engage one and how to report it. We had the famous Roswell case, where bodies and a craft were supposedly recovered. So why didn't we have amazing flying vehicles and, you know, free energy for everyone? Why would you keep that from people? Elitism. Obviously, it's not your standard radar installation that monitors the skies for UFO tracking. And it's not your regular army that goes out and recovers crashed UFOs. As everyone here knows, these projects are special access and secret compartmented. So very few people see the big picture. And if there are any so-called disruptive technologies, they end up in the hands of a relatively small group of people, probably in the 10,000 or less, I would guess, rather than the public at large. And secrets are never good in any relationship, but secrets kept from the people and the state by forces unknown are the worst kind of secrets. So I started to wonder, you know, would it be possible to seek out the truth of the matter via the internet and by using my networking knowledge to track down these unknown forces and get a look at their data? To many people, this, you know, just seems like a mad idea, but to me it was a noble cause and worth looking into. But it's a big problem. You know, how do you track down a secret group of elitists coveting recovered alien technology that probably have their own quantum computing network and time travel machines by now? Who knows? Would they even have data on the internet? Well, you don't know until you try, but where do you start? Then sometime in the spring of 2001, I think it was, I was told about Dr. Stephen Greer's upcoming Disclosure Project conference at the National Press Club in D.C. And he was a man who spent years gathering together the most incredible UFO witness list, interviewing them, bonding with them, respecting their anonymity when required. And as I listened to him speak with like true passion and eloquence about the subject, he became an instant hero to me. Instant hero. Right up there with the likes of Linda Moulton Howe, Bud Hopkins, Stanton Friedman, and many, many others in the UFO field. It was an amazing body of evidence, and all from the mouths of mature retirees in the main, who held positions ranging from radar hardware engineers to US Air Force lieutenant colonels and above, you know, generals. And these people were from all of the armed forces right across the board, as well as witnesses from the intelligence community. It really was a fantastic collection of people telling their stories. I bought the Disclosure Project book, wanting to know more of these people's stories and, more importantly, to use the book for intelligence gathering on possible locations that were internet-connected and had something to do with the UFO cover-up. And having read the book, as far as I was concerned, Dr. Greer's star witness in this concern was Donna Hare. Here was a woman who'd been inside one of NASA's sanitizing labs, where they regularly remove UFOs from satellite and spacecraft imagery. She was an image specialist. I think she was doing launch lines at the time. And she said that the lab she saw was in Building 8 of Johnson Space Center. And I was absolutely gobsmacked. It was amazing. I had a physical location that was fairly specific, down to the building that the lab was in. She said she'd been in the lab and been shown one of the photographs by one of her colleagues, which he shouldn't have really done, because that should be secret compartmented as well. But thank God he did, because now we know. But how do you get into a network like that? And it turned out to be all too easy, far too easy. I wish it hadn't been easy, though. I wouldn't be here today. Computer communication languages are called network protocols. The HTTP you use in your web browser is a protocol, standing for Hypertext Transfer Protocol. Your email service runs an IMAP, which is Internet Message Access Protocol. So there's protocols for specific jobs, as well as general protocols that provide for computer-to-computer communication. One of these general protocols is called NetBIOS, which stands for Network Basic Input System. As its name suggests, it's a system that provides basic input-output across the network. For instance, if your office is on a Windows network, when you copy and paste a file from your machine to a colleague's shared drive, it's NetBIOS doing all the legwork and allowing both computers to talk to each other. So that's what NetBIOS is for. It's for local area networks like offices or homes. It's not very secure. Unfortunately, at that time, an out-of-the-box Windows installation defaulted to using NetBIOS not just across your home or office network, but also across the internet, basically exposing your network to the world. And one method NetBIOS uses for access to any network resource is the standard username and password combination. And the administrator username, the administrator account, is the most powerful account on the PC, apart from the system itself. And it has access to almost anything. So it was obvious to me that I had to scan the JSC, Johnson Space Center network, looking for PCs that accepted NetBIOS connections, and then see if they had either weak passwords or unset passwords on the administrator accounts. And it was quite a quick scan. It didn't take long. A surprising number of PCs responded to NetBIOS probes and also returned administrator accounts that had no password set, not just a weak password like password itself, literally no password blank. Excuse me. So it was very easy to set up a tunnel between me and the remote PC that I could use to install remote control software, a bit like PC Anywhere. So it's literally like you're there on the screen, like you're sitting at the monitor of the other computer. You could use a mouse, interact with the desktop, etc. Before installing the remote control software, I first had to find out which PCs were in Building 8. This was accomplished by using NetBIOS commands again to list the PCs on the remote network. Luckily for me, NASA's IT people were very diligent in their hardware auditing. Every PC had location information as well as serial numbers and the like for auditing purposes. So it didn't take long to compile a list of Building 8 machines that also had administrator accounts that had no passwords. So, I installed the remote control software on the first PC in the list, logged on and looked at the desktop, which is fairly minimal, if I recall correctly, but it had two interesting folders, just like Donna said. One was called RAW and the other was called Processed, or similar words, I can't remember exactly. I double-clicked on the RAW folder and there was a huge list of files, many of them being over 200 megabytes in size, which was quite large back in dial-up days, because it took about 5 or 6 minutes just for 1 megabyte back then. I considered transferring a few of the files in one go, but thought I'd best inspect one of them first. I can't remember the file extension, but it was a proprietary NASA format, not one of the common image formats. So I just double-clicked one of the files, and the associated imaging software launched, and I waited. And then I waited, and then sort of line by line, very slow, very jerky, the image started appearing on the screen, but it was painfully slow. So I shut down the imaging software. I turned the color down to 4 bits, possibly 2 bits, so you get a lot less color. Turned the resolution down to, I think, 640 by 480 in order to get a look at this image as quickly as possible, you know, in low color, low resolution, and then download it, then close the connection. So I thought I had plenty of time. You know, I thought I was going to watch this, then transfer it across. I launched the image again, and it was still painfully slow, but it was a few times faster than it was the first time around. And the top second section of the image just seemed to be like a muddy sort of black and grey. But then the hemisphere of a planet started to appear. And I began to see like cloud formations. I don't remember seeing any recognizable terrain or any terrain at all. I just assumed it was Earth, because it was, you know, white clouds, and the muddy darkness was obviously the space above Earth. And then the craft began to appear. First thing I saw was the top of a dome, because although it was classic cigar-shaped, it had these sort of geodesic golf ball, you know, like radar domes above and below. And no features on the craft at all, no insignia, no rivets, no seams, no sign of your standard man-made manufacturing at all, very smooth, one-piece object. Then I jumped to my seat because the mouse started to move, you know, on its own. It obviously wasn't moving on its own. Someone who was physically at the machine had seen what I was doing, and they moved the mouse pointer over to the network icon in the system tray, right-clicked it, and chose disconnect. I couldn't believe it, you know, as I was watching. I hadn't even seen the whole image yet, and I'd been disconnected. So that was my eureka moment, but I also lost connection at the same time. But I had seen it. I found exactly what Donna Hare had said would be there, exactly where she said it would be, a sanitizing lab in Building 8 of Johnson Space Center that processed the imagery. And the first image I looked at featured some kind of exotic craft. So this, it was confirmation in my eyes. It was confirmation of Donna Hare's amazing story. I also found another piece of evidence. I think it was on a Navy network. I can't quite remember. It supports the secret space fleet theory. It was an Excel spreadsheet entitled Non-Terrestrial Officers. I don't know if that was the file name or just the title once you were in the spreadsheet. It had names, ranks, ship names, list of materiel, spelled an E at the end, you know, materiel, meaning military materials, chemicals, like exotic sounding chemicals that were under ship-to-ship transfers and fleet-to-fleet transfers. So, yeah, quite an exotic document. It it was almost like you found the admin office of a secret space program. You had non-terrestrial officers that, and I googled the phrase at the time, it was nowhere to be found, and now if you google it, it's just in connection with my story. That's still in my hard drive in Washington, and the office of the ONI, the Office of Naval Intelligence. I don't think I'll see that drive again. And just to set one thing straight, I don't remember any of the ship names. You know, I've seen a few people on YouTube and the web and said, oh, he saw, you know, the USS such and such, and but that's not true. I don't remember any of the names. And that's my story. Thank you for listening.